Good afternoon. So last time we started talking about semaphores, which we had were these synchronization objects that kept a counter internally, though we didn't actually read the counter directly. We just did the bookkeeping to maintain it at the correct value. And we had two operations for that. We had an up operation, which incremented the counter, and a down operation, which decremented the counter, but first waited if the count was already zero, so we never had the count be negative. And our intuition is that we track some quantity of some resource that's available and use up and down to bookkeep when there's more or less of that. And because the down operation waits when there's none of the resource, this will naturally cause us to wait when we need some more of a resource to be available. And this like fit naturally in our producer-consumer pattern, where our resource was either things that have been produced or places to produce things. We also mentioned that in addition to counting semaphores, there is this simpler idea of binary semaphores. Well, simpler in the sense that if you were implementing these semaphores, it would be simpler. Not so much simpler in the sense that, well, now you have to figure out how to use something that's less capable to do the same patterns. Mention that binary semaphores and counting semaphores can accomplish the same things. You can use a set of binary semaphores to implement a counting semaphore. The basic idea is you have an actual count and you use a binary semaphore to implement, making sure only one thread changes the count at a time, and another one to implement the wake-up operation. And we saw that semaphores and monitors also can accomplish the same things, and we proved that by showing, well, you can implement monitors with semaphores, and you can implement semaphores with monitors. And when we were looking at how we implemented monitors with semaphores, we saw this useful pattern which we use to implement condition variables that we could track the number of things that were waiting and use this to implement a wake-up operation for just what was waiting. And we're going to see that pattern again. It's useful not just with semaphores, but it's also going to be useful with monitors. And it also shows us how we can use semaphores to track something where, you know, it's not so directly a quantity of things. Instead, we like compute, do I need to wake someone up? We can do that with semaphores by just tracking how many people would I need to wake up. So after that, we started looking at reader-writer locks. We mentioned that reader-writer locks were like barriers, a synchronization construct that wasn't very general, but was for a specific pattern that just comes up all the time. And we saw reader-writer locks solve this problem of, I have some shared resource that as many people as I want can read at the same time, and there's no problem. But if I have one thread writing the resource, no one else can touch it. And reader-writer locks solve the problem of allowing multiple readers, but only allowing one writer at a time. And we showed last time an implementation with monitors, but it had this problem that we didn't specify what happens when we could either let a writer go or let a reader go and access the resource. That the solution in the what I showed was that we just woke up a writer, and had them fight it out. One of them would get there first, and they would start using the resource. The other one would double check after waiting, hey, can I actually access this thing, and find out, no, there's a reader if I'm the writer, or there's a writer if I'm the readers. And that's dissatisfying for probably two reasons. So one reason it was pretty dissatisfying is that, well, that means we're waking threads up that can't actually do anything. And that's going to waste CPU time. We don't want to do that. And another reason is that we'd really like to make a particular choice. So Next, I'll go on and talk about how we're going to make that particular choice. But before that, questions about what we covered last time, in particular semaphore, since I'm not going to discuss that if we don't have questions on it. Okay. So let's look at this priority issue. There's a policy question here of when we have a choice between letting a writer go and letting a reader go, do you let the writers go or the readers go? So we'll have what we'll call writer priority versus reader priority. And we'll make an explicit decision about it. When we build our reader-writer lock with monitors, we're going to decide, hey, if a writer is waiting, they should get to go as soon as possible. If a reader is waiting, the reader should get to go as soon as possible. And so we'll have these policies where I'll say that, hey, if a writer is waiting, we should stop all the readers so the writer can go. Or if a reader is waiting, we should stop all the writers so the readers can go. So those are our two policies. And we can observe that this is an additional reason we need to wait. So when we started out with our reader-writer lock, we said the writers wait if there's any readers or writers right now. Now we have this additional condition that they also wait if there are readers waiting, if the readers have priority. So in order to implement that reason for waiting, we need to track the number of waiting readers and writers. So in addition to tracking how many readers or writers are active, we want to track the number of active ones, the number of waiting ones, so we can use that information to decide whether we need to wait. So we can use this to extend the reader-writer lock we ended with last time to implement one of these two writer-favoring policies or reader-favoring policies. And I'll start with the writer-favoring policies. And here, we're adding this extra condition that no readers go when writers are waiting. So to do that, we're going to figure out, well, is a writer waiting? We need to know that, so we're going to track how many writers are waiting. So tracking how many writers are waiting, that means that when a writer comes in, it hasn't been allowed to write yet, but it's waiting to write, it's going to increment the number of writers that are waiting while it's waiting, and when it's done waiting, it's going to decrement that. And this information is going to let the readers figure out, oh, there's a writer waiting, I can't go now, we have to let the writer take its turn. And we're also going to use this information to avoid what the most obvious form of this priority issue was, which was that previously we were always signaling a writer and signaling all the readers. Now we have the information to know, is there a writer to signal? And if there's a writer to signal, we're going to signal them. Otherwise, we're going to wake up all the readers. We're not going to do both. Questions? Got this. So the process I went through here is I realized that we had a problem previously where we were doing the signal and broadcast unconditionally, and I really wanted to decide who to wake up, so I wrote down a rule for making that decision. And when I wrote down that rule, I realized I needed to track some extra information to implement it, so I just tracked that information. I wanted to know how many writers are waiting, and you know, I can figure that out by making sure the writers that are waiting help me figure that out by keeping track of how many there are. And so now that we have this, we can look at how this would operate. So let's say here I have a reader-writer lock, and I have four threads involved. The first two threads are going to read, the third thread's going to write, and the fourth thread is going to read. And initially, none of the threads has accessed the reader-writer lock. They're doing something else. So we have our counts of the number of writers, number of readers, and the number of waiting writers. Then, then the first thread comes along and it tries to get a read lock. So the read lock is going to look at this condition and say, oh, are there any writers or reader or waiting writers? And the answer is going to be no. So it's not going to wait. It's just going to increment the number of readers. And what we'll say is acquire the read lock. It means it's allowed to read whatever resource this lock protects. And the same thing might happen when reader 2 comes along. So now we have two readers, no writers, and no waiting writers. Then writer 1, our third thread, comes along, and it's going to have to wait. Our condition, which we didn't need to change because the writers don't wait in any additional cases, is if while there are any readers or writers, we can't go right away. Yes, the writers have priority, but they don't have so much priority that they get to kick out the readers that are reading. That makes sense because it would be really hard to write code that allowed us to interrupt a reader while it's reading. So it's just going to record itself as waiting while before it starts waiting. So you have one waiting writer, and that's going to come up when the third reader comes along. So the third reader comes along, and it's going to be waiting. And the reason it's going to be waiting is it's going to look and say, oh, there's a waiting writer. I can't go now. And eventually, our readers which got to go are going to stop reading, and they're going to decrement the number of readers. And when the last one decrements the number of readers, we have no readers, we'll signal, hey, someone can write now. And that's going to wake up our write lock thread. So that thread's going to go. It's going to decrement the number of waiting writers, increment the number of writers to 1. And while this is happening, we still have this fourth thread waiting for a read lock. It never gets it yet because our rule was the writers go first. So after all the readers that already started were finished, the writer got to go as soon as we could let it go without messing up people who are already reading. So it gets to write and read. And when it finishes, it's going to realize, oh, there's no other waiting writers. That means now I can wake up these readers who are waiting behind me. And finally, our last reader will get to go. So questions about how this worked? Okay. So that's our writer priority lock. And you see, so we're tracking the number of waiting writers, and we have this behavior that once a writer comes along, the other threads start paying attention to the fact that there's someone waiting to write and hold on, wait in line behind it. So we could also implement the reader priority version. And for the reader priority version, when we look at our rule here, for the reader priority version, the rule was that writers don't get to go when there's a reader waiting. So we're going to do the opposite. We're going to have to track, is there a reader waiting? So we're going to have to know how many waiting readers there are, not how many waiting writers. And we're going to have to change the condition for writers going. So we're going to have to stall writers while there's some reader waiting, and also make sure that if there's a reader waiting, that we wake up the reader in preference to waking up any writers. So that yields this version. So we have our waiting readers. Oh, and I have an unnecessary condition here. I have readers equals 0. This doesn't do anything because there can't be any readers when the write lock finishes. So we check the waiting readers, and we also check to figure out whether we want to signal a writer, are there no waiting readers? If there's no waiting readers, we wake up a writer, otherwise we let readers go. And we have our extra condition that writers don't get to go if there's readers or writers or even waiting readers. Yes? So, question, is there a difference besides the flip-flopping? Basically not. So, we're doing the same thing, but for readers. Writers. And in general, you know, if I just showed you like two policies, we could implement some other policies. So, let's say I want to implement kind of an in-between policy where I have reader priority except if the writers wait more than 1 second. So a problem with reader priority is that if there's lots of readers, the writers absolutely never get to go. We have starvation. So one way of fixing that would be to say, yeah, the reader should go, but don't let the writers wait too long. So how could we implement that? What extra things should we track? Check with your neighbor, see if say you have a thought. What's something else we should track?
Maybe in read block, you have a check. While writers is 9.0, but we could have like that, unless writers is too long, and then you could, you know, not.
Okay, so you want here this to be writers not equal to zero.
And writers is not like greater than some other value.
Yeah, and we want to keep waiting. And no writer has waited too long. So that's one thing we want to fix. So we want to have this condition for the read lock to be, you know, we want to wait while there's no writers, you know, we want to wait while there's writers, and we want to wait while there's no writers, while there's writers, or while a writer has waited too long. I should do this. Sorry. So this is when we want to wait. We want to wait as long as there's a writer or a writer has waited for too long. So a waiting writer, I'll make that clearer. So a waiting writer, so not an actual writer, has waited for too long. So we want to check, is there anyone writing? Then we can't go. Or if no one's writing, but someone wants to write and they've been waiting for too long. So that's our extra condition. Is there any other extra conditions we need to change? Yeah. So this is if waiting readers is zero or a writer has been waiting for too long. Waiting too long. Okay? We want to signal in that case. Okay, any other conditions we need to change? Two more candidates. There's the one in write lock and the one in write unlock. Do any of those need to change? There.
In write lock, we also in the while statement, we also need to have an or. Writers waiting too long.
Okay. So we want to do something while this is true. And we have not been waiting for too long. Have not been waiting for too long. For too long. And readers plus writers is zero. So if we've been waiting for too long, we want the condition without waiting readers, basically. So we don't count the waiting readers if we've been waiting too long in that loop. Okay. And any, how about, is there anything in write unlock that needs to change? Okay.
So like when it hits the else statement, you also need to check, or but sorry, waiting reader is equal zero, or writer has waited too long.
Or writer waited too long. Okay. So we need to change all these conditions. So this seems like a lot of tricky cases. So let's have some intuition for how we figure out, you know, how to do that. And one way of thinking about this is that I'm waiting on OK to read here. And when I'm waiting has to be consistent with when it gets broadcast. So that's one thing to think about. And so that's one way we could have figured out, wait a moment, the write unlock condition maybe doesn't make sense. Another thing we could look at is the same thing with the write lock condition. This OK to write condition needs to be consistent with when it gets signaled in both of the cases. And that would be a way of telling us that, wait a moment, if I need to change the condition on either of those, either of any of those three places, I must need to change all the other ones because they have to be consistent with each other. Because if we wait for different reasons than we signal, you know, there's some inconsistency and we need to think about, is that okay? And, you know, as for whether it's okay, like if it's the case that we're getting signaled in some cases when we'll go back to sleep, like it's going to be slow, but at least it's not going to be wrong. If it's the case that we're not signaling in some cases when we would want to be, that's going to be real bad. We're just going to hang. So questions? What I did here. OK, so that's about and signal. Okay, so that's where I'll finish up on reader-writer lock. So our next topic is going to be about something called deadlock. And I'll start with a simple example. So let's say we have a one-way bridge here, and we have two cars, and the drivers decide, well, the road in front of me is free, I'll just keep driving. They go here and say, huh, the road in front of me is not free. The other driver will figure it out. I'll just wait. Yeah, so when are they going to stop waiting? You know, just looking ahead, you know, saying, yep, can't go right now. Just, you know, eventually, sure, got cleared up. And the answer is never. So this is a problem we call deadlock. Both of the drivers are waiting for each other. And if they're going to be stubborn about it and just keep waiting, you know, we're never going to solve this problem. They're just going to be sitting there because only one car can go across that bridge. So another classic example of this problem is this thought problem of we have five philosophers at a table and they're eating with chopsticks and we're very bad at setting our table. So we've decided to put one chopstick between each of them. Yeah, well, if you look where you're sitting, like, yes, when they tested this, you know, any one person could eat at any seat, so it must be fine. And, yeah, let's say that all these philosophers decide, okay, well, I want to eat, I'm going to pick up chopstick on my left side, then my right side, and we're fine. And we'll just wait. If it's not there, someone will put it back. So they all pick up their left chopstick. And then they look for their right chopstick. And if they don't, someone doesn't give up. They're all stubborn. Well, no one gets to eat unless they can figure out how to use only just one chopstick. And so unlike our example with cars, in this example, you know, we can't actually look at, you know, any one person and any two people and say, well, they're not making any progress because of the other one directly. It's indirect. And that's why this type of problem is not so trivial to find. Because we can't just say, of course you're waiting on me and I'm waiting on you. Often it's going to be the case that, you know, I'm not waiting on you, but I'm waiting on someone else who's waiting on someone else who's waiting on you. Okay. Now, these are both examples of what I call deadlock, which seem hopelessly artificial. Like, why am I talking about it in an operating systems class? When is this going to ever happen in any computer program? So let's go to an example with a computer program with pipes that we've seen. So here I have a child and parent process, and they want to communicate with each other. So in this case, I'm writing a buffer, but you could imagine that maybe that's like computed worth code I'm not showing you. So the idea is that the child is going to write some things to the parent and read back what the parent wrote to it, and vice versa. So two-way communication between two processes. Seems like actually a thing you might really want to do in an example where it's not the same buffer each time, but like you're computing something. And this hangs forever. And what's the problem? Why does it hang? This is the same reason that many of you experienced the large amount of data through pipe test hanging on the shell assignments. Yeah?
So the parent and child are both going to write these buffers and fill them up, and then they're not going to be able to write anymore until someone agrees from it to clear out space, but they're never going to get that reconstruction for waiting to finish their writing.
Yeah, so you're saying they're both writing to buffers that implement the two pipes we've made, and that write is going to wait until that buffer is drained by someone reading. And if we look at this code and say, you know, does someone read the pipe? The answer is absolutely yes. But the problem is that they only read the pipe after writing to the other one. So we have a deadlock here, which is the child is writing to the pipe, waiting for free buffer space to finish its write, which won't be available until the parent reads later on. So then we have to ask the question, well, what's the parent doing? Well, the parent's writing to a different pipe, waiting for free buffer space, which won't be available until the child reads it later on. And if we go back to ask what the child's doing, we go back to the beginning, we're at an impasse unless someone changes what they're doing. And a convenient way of representing this kind of situation is going to be to draw a graph in the sense of like a 2150 graph, one of these graphs. So we can say that the parent process will represent things it's waiting for as arrows from it to something, and will represent things that it's going to free up, that's going to deal with later, as we'll see later, things that it like conceptually, you know, controls and is responsible for with arrows from some resource to it. So the parent process is waiting for space to write, and the child process waiting for space to write on the buffer for the pipe from the parent to the child. But that needs to be read by the child process to free space. But for that to happen, the child process is waiting for space to write on the other pipe's buffer, which needs to be read to free space. And we have a problem here because this created a cycle. So a way we can think more systematically about these sorts of problems I've shown you is that when we draw this graph, we get this bad cycle. So this is a deadlock with pipes, but we're talking about deadlocks after talking about multiple threads, because the most frequent case where deadlocks come about is in multi-threaded programs, and in particular when you're using things like locks or monitors or semaphores. So let's look at an example where we have deadlock with that. So here I'm saying we have an operating system where we represent directories with this struct. It has a lock because we have multiple threads accessing the same directory. That's a perfectly reasonable thing to do. And we want to make sure that that's synchronized, but if two threads want to access different directories, we want them to run at the same time. We don't want to, have them take turns for different directories. So we have one lock for each directory, and we just have a mapping of strings to directory entries in the directory. And I have a move file operation, which is going to take a file from one directory and move it to another by just moving the directory entry and deleting the original directory entry, copying the directory entry, deleting the original. And we want to make sure that while we're doing this, no one gets confused about the contents of the map. In particular, probably it's not safe to access that entry's map while it's being changed, or else we might use a dangling pointer or something like that, which would be very bad. So to prevent that, we lock both directories, do the move operation, and unlock them. And this can cause a deadlock, and it, in fact, can cause a deadlock when we look at the operations, it doesn't really look like we're accessing the same thing. If we have one thread moving a file from A to B, while another thread moves a file from B to A, where A and B are directories, we can have a deadlock. And this is a particularly unfortunate deadlock because from a perspective of should these calls interfere with each other, the answer seems to be no. They're actually working on different files. Just happens they share some directories. There's nothing logically wrong with what we're doing. So let's look at how the deadlock happens. But first, I'm going to look at how this could just work fine. And that's an annoying thing about this problem that we're calling deadlock, is that sometimes it's just going to work out. So this could just work out because thread one does the move before thread two. If that happens, everything's great. And this seems like an advantage, but it's not an advantage because we just got lucky here. And if we got lucky when we were testing and then didn't get lucky when we actually gave this to a customer or something or deployed it in reality, it would be unfortunate, and we could definitely get unlucky. We could also have had these run at the same time and still gotten lucky, where thread two runs while thread one's doing the move. That's also not a problem. We'll wait for the lock, no issue. So these are both cases where nothing bad happens. In this case, they're even trying to do it at the same time, and it works out fine. But where it doesn't work out fine is where we have the unlucky case where things run just close enough to cause our problem. And that's going to be that thread one is going to lock A, Thread 2 is going to lock B. Everything's fine here. We can do that. But now, the next thing thread 1 wants to do, it wants to lock the other directory it's working with, which is B. It can't do that because thread 2 has it locked. So it's going to wait. And, well, what's thread 2 going to do? It's going to try to lock the other directory it's dealing with, which is A, which thread 1 has locked. And now we have the same sort of situation we had on that bridge. Both of the threads are just saying, well, you're going to give me that other directory. I'm just going to wait here until you do it. And we have a standoff. You know, so we'll never, ever run the code that actually does the move operation or unlocks the locks. They'll just stay locked forever because there's nothing in our code to do anything else. Questions? This scenario. So we can represent this with our graph view like this, that, you know, thread one is waiting for lock on A, which is held by thread two, waiting for a lock on B. So we have this circular dependency. So, and I might have mixed up directory A and B here, but same idea. So we have the circular dependency where basically thread 1's waiting on thread 2 and thread 2's waiting on thread 1. They're not waiting directly. They didn't call wait on thread 1, but they have a resource in common, a lock, that is making that happen. And that's where our problem is. And one solution you might have for this is, well, let's just make sure we detect if you're doing A to B and B to A at the same time and stop that. And that indeed will stop this deadlock. But the problem is that, like with our dining philosopher's example, we can have this be less direct. So here, this was easy because we can just say thread 1 is waiting on 2, is waiting on 1 with only a little indirection. We had to look at the locks, but that was enough to figure out what was going on. But we could have the same scenario with three threads. We could have thread 1 waiting on thread 2, waiting on thread 3, waiting on thread 1 with three different directories being involved. So I'm moving from one is moving from C to A, some file. Two is moving from A to B, and three is moving from B to C. And these all happening at the same time cause a more complicated version of the same problem, where instead of having two threads doing nothing, we have three threads doing nothing, and also three locks that are never, ever going to get unlocked. Some questions? So I showed you deadlock with locks and with pipe buffers. We can also have this with all sorts of other resources. So let's give an example of free space. So here I have two threads that we're going to allocate memory. But rather than having a version of malloc that just returns an error when we don't have enough memory, why don't we just have a version which is going to wait? And wait for there to be enough memory. You know, I know the system has 2 meg of memory, so of course both of these threads should be able to run fine. But we'll end up with deadlock in some cases, because they don't allocate all the memory at once. One thread gets a megabyte, asks for the second megabyte, well, the other thread does that, and they're both going to have their standoff where they're saying, you're going to release that megabyte, so I'll just wait here. I'm more patient. And they're both infinitely patient. We never actually free up the space. And this is a little trickier to represent as a graph. I'll use this sort of graph where I have this sort of complex node with divided resources. This is a bit trickier because, well, you know, we have this divisible thing that's allocated in pieces, and what matters is both of them want all the remaining pieces. This is another example of a deadlock. And note that, again, like our prior case with locks, we could have gotten lucky. Could have been the case that they just executed slightly different timings, and everything would be fine. Okay. So these were all examples of, as I said, were called deadlock. So I'm going to start by being more formal about defining what deadlock is. And by defining it, we're going to talk about systematic ways of avoiding it. Because as you saw with the move file example, particularly when you're writing threaded code, you could accidentally have deadlocks in your code. And testing for them, because you can get lucky in so many ways and not have the deadlock happen, is pretty tricky. So we're going to instead want some way of knowing that there's not a deadlock there. So our deadlock, we're saying it's circular waiting for resources. And as you saw, though locks are perhaps the most straightforward example of where deadlocks would happen, we can have it occur with all sorts of resources. And often, but not always, it's non-deterministic. So one thing about deadlock is that it seems similar to one thing we discussed before, which is starvation. And deadlock is not starvation. And the difference is that deadlock is, in a sense, worse than starvation. So in starvation, there is one thread or more which doesn't make any progress. And that's what deadlock is. Like, one or more thread doesn't make any progress. But when there's starvation, that thread isn't making progress because someone else is taking their resources. So someone gets to make progress when there's starvation, just not everyone. There's someone left out. With deadlock, everyone who's involved in the deadlock never makes progress. So deadlock is just a lose-lose situation. Starvation, so there is a winner in starvation. There's no winners in deadlock. Another thing about starvation is that starvation is easier to solve once it happens. So if we have starvation, if we just take turns without whatever resource is being starved, we just switch to a policy that actually fairly divides up the resource, we can fix it. With deadlock, that is not going to be a solution. That there's no way I can offer the other thread, the other lock, with the way locks work. There's no way I can free up the buffer space and have take turns in the pipes with the way pipes work. Okay. So questions about deadlock versus starvation? Okay, so let's talk a little about formally defining deadlock. So there's going to be four requirements we're going to use to define deadlock. So one is that we need mutual exclusion, that resources need to have one thread at a time. If the resource can be shared between all the threads, you know, if we're talking about like acquiring a read lock on one resource and there's no write locks, well, there's no problem, right? We don't have to do anything. Of course, everyone can read it. So we need some sort of mutual exclusion. That means that all the threads can't just use the resource simultaneously. We need to have this hold and wait property, that when one thread is using the resource, using some resource, it can wait to acquire another resource. That if we never wait, we don't have this problem. So, and we need to wait while we have some other resource. We also need to not have what I'll call preemptions of resources. That once I get a resource and I'm holding it, it doesn't get taken from under me. And we see this with locks, that it just doesn't make sense to get rid of a lock someone has, because who knows what they're doing with the resource that lock is supposed to keep us in sync with. So there's no way of stealing resources from another. And we also need a circular wait, meaning that I can come up with a list of threads. So the first depends on the second, depends on the third, depends on the fourth, depends on the fifth, depends on the first. Where it could be more than five, it could be any number, but there's some list which has that cycle. Note that we say there exists one. There could be multiple such sets. We could have multiple cycles of waiting in like a really bad, complicated deadlock case. And we'll look at this definition in a bit to figure out how we can prevent deadlock. First, talk about questions on this definition. Okay, so now that we've discussed what deadlock is with examples and a definition, here is some code. How can this deadlock? So I have a linked list A, B, C, D, E, and I have this remove node function, which tries to remove something from my linked list. It only works on internal nodes, but that's not a problem because all the exam question options I have here are dealing with B, C, or D. So we don't have to worry about the ends. The question is, which of these could deadlock? Now, it's going to be the case that there's going to be a scenario where you can call them in parallel and they don't deadlock, but I'm asking, which is there some way for them to deadlock if you call them at the same time? And ideally, you should think of how can I show that there shouldn't be a deadlock based on the definition we just had? Like, what properties are going to help? Oh, and I have the answer options out of order. Okay, that is something to note for next lecture. Let's just call this G. you'd like more time? Okay, so my apologies for not checking the order of my option letters somehow. So who thinks B and D at the same time? Remove node B and remove node D. How about remove node B and remove node C? Okay. How about remove node B and remove node C and remove node D? Okay. And the combination of remove node B and D and remove node B, C, and D. And the combination of remove node B and C and remove node B, C, and D. So we have mostly agreement. And how about all of the above? Okay, some for all of the above, some for none of the above. So I believe the answer is B and C. So let's go through how removing B and removing C at the same time is going to be a problem. That we're going to lock B, then we're going to lock its previous, and then its next. So we lock B, then A, then try to lock C, and remove C can lock C, and then wait to lock B, and this is a deadlock. We have an additional lock of A, which doesn't matter, but we have our deadlock with B and C. And B and D together alone can't be a problem because we can't have circular wait. And the way we can prove that, if there's one resource in common, one lock in common, and either the thread removing B is going to get it first, and the thread removing D is going to wait until afterwards, or vice versa, but we can't have the thread removing B depend on D and the other way around because we only have one way to have a dependency, which is that single resource in common, that single lock. And we need more than a single lock to have a deadlock, a single lock in common. So because there's only one in common, not going to be a problem. When we have B, C, and D, well, B and C running in parallel can deadlock, and D at the same time, well, we still have a deadlock if D finishes normally, but D cannot finish normally because it can be waiting for the lock on C that's held in the deadlock and therefore wait forever, like, even though it's not the cause of the deadlock. Okay, so questions? This reasoning. So let's look at techniques for preventing deadlock, and we're going to go back to our definition and figure out how can we break each of these properties to make sure we don't have a deadlock. So I'll start with some of these techniques are going to seem kind of silly, but there's special cases where they work. So one technique is infinite resources, or at least enough resources that will never run out in any time that we care about. And this gets rid of mutual exclusion. We don't have only one thread at a time can take some resource, you know, because there's infinite copies of it. So one example of where this is actually practical is if you think about memory and swap space, that a solution for how are you, you know, waiting for someone else to get memory is just have a lot of swap space that I can allocate. And if that's effectively infinite, then we'll never have that deadlock. We'll do something maybe not so great of using disk instead. That's a solution. Or just giving more resources. Another trivial option is no shared resources. If I have two processes that don't share anything, can't have a deadlock. Not always practical, but that's a solution. So in our memory case, we can say, we're just going to say, you have 5 meg of memory for every process, and that's it. There's not a deadlock because every process has a separate pool. They don't share what memory is available. We can get rid of waiting. So with memory, this is how memory usually works. You call malloc, it doesn't work. You don't wait for more memory. You just crash. No waiting. No deadlock possible. So you can think of this as sort of a busy signal is one way, so where you're going to abort and maybe retry. So that's what like malloc does normally. It doesn't wait for more memory. It just says, you don't have memory. We're done. You could also implement this with revoking resources or preempting resources. So the reason we don't have to worry about deadlock with the CPU usually is that we can take the CPU away from a program that's using it right now. So we don't actually have this hold and wait property. So let's look at, you know, busy signal, as I said. You could just, our normal allocations don't have this problem. So another model I mentioned you can have revoke resources is that we could have an allocate or steal function. We could say, instead of malloc working normally, we could say malloc is going to allocate a meg of memory, and if there's not a meg available, we're just going to find a program with the meg of memory and kill it. And now there's a meg available. Can't have deadlock in this scenario. Now, you might have some problems with this, which is like, why are we killing random programs? Maybe that's not acceptable, but it does solve the deadlock problem. It just, there's a question of when is it useful. Now, I gave these examples with memory, and it seems like, gosh, we could never do this with locks. That's not how locks work. But we could. So, for example, pthreads provides a mutex trilock, which is basically lock or fail. So if the lock's not available right now, rather than waiting for it, it gives up. So you could use that to implement the abort when you don't get the lock operation and avoid deadlock that way. Now, there's a question of what would you do when you abort that's useful? Do you just say, sorry, I couldn't remove the node? Sorry, I couldn't move the file? Like, you could do that, but usually that's not an acceptable option. But in cases where it is, you have that mechanism. You can have this trilock operation. Another thing is that you could have revocable locks. You could have some way of saying, hey, I've waited too long for this lock. Just get rid of the person who has it and somehow figure out how to do cleanup. And some databases actually implement this strategy where they keep track of enough information to figure out what was the thing which had the lock doing and how can I undo that. So they can take the lock out from under it and solve the deadlock that way. And you know, a way you might imagine this is imagine like you just throw an exception when you revoke the lock and you have to implement a correct exception handler that gets things in an okay state. Before you let the other thread go. Okay. Now, so we can do this abort and retry thing, but it has some problems. So let's think of abort and retry. So let me first show you our move example with abort and retry implemented. So I have a hypothetical trilock. This is not the pthreads API, but let's say I call trilock, and I try to lock the from directory and the to directory. And as long as that works, and there's some error checking missing here, you know, missing error checking. So I guess that this should be a normal lock, but so we lock the from lock, then we try to lock the to lock. If that doesn't work, if that works, we're done. Otherwise, we unlock the from lock, try again. Okay, so this is abort and retry solution. We can't have deadlock here. But most of you probably aren't really happy with this solution. Because the natural question is, how many times can that loop run? And the answer is as many as you want is possible. Like, sky is the limit. You could just keep trying and trying and trying and never have this actually work. But we just keep trying, have the two threads get the lock, and each time they conflict with each other, we produce deadlock. So this is a problem that's not deadlock, Because, hey, the threads are trying to do something. And also, if we like take turns correctly, like we would actually would fix the problem. So this is a problem known as live lock. The threads are alive. They're just not getting any work done. But unlike deadlock, they're not waiting for anything. And this is arguably worse than deadlock, because with deadlock, you like take out your debugger, and you find out, oh, the threads aren't doing anything. That's weird. Or you like look at your system monitor and you say, 0% CPU? What's happening here? With live lock, you take out your debugger and you say, oh no, they're just moving files. Okay, no problem. And you look at your system monitor, yeah, doing a lot of work. Seems fine. Well, I don't know why it takes so long. Like, so arguably a worse problem. Now, how can we prevent live lock? What would be a solution to avoid the problem? You know, if we want to do this abort and retry thing, how can we make that not have this keep abort and retry almost forever problem? Yeah. Okay, so you're saying if we abort and retry too much, we should just choose a process to run. Yeah, that is indeed a real solution. So we can like somehow have a live lock detector where you say, abort rate was too high. If abort rate's too high, stop all the other processes but one, or other threads but one. Okay, so that is indeed a real solution. So that's this second solution I had written down there. Another simpler but maybe less reliable solution is you make the schedule random. So a common thing to do is if the try lock fails, you wait for a random amount of time. And the idea is that with high probability, the two or more threads that are deadlocked will wait for different random amounts of time, and someone will go first, changing the order and breaking the deadlock. Breaking the live lock, I should say, not re-triggering the would-be deadlock if we were waiting scenario. And there might be other solutions that would work. I mentioned we can revoke or preempt resources. So that's another option. So we could have revocable locks somehow where there's like, you know, code like this where we acquire the shared data, and if someone revokes the lock, it runs our undo code and we release the lock right away. But usually this is very difficult to implement because you have to be very careful to both structure your code this way and also test that undo operation code and make sure it actually works in all cases. So these are techniques we talked about for preventing deadlock, which we probably won't use. We'll instead use this last technique, acquiring the resources in a consistent order. And the reason for this is that by having a consistent order, we can prevent the circular waiting. That for the circular waiting, we need to have A depend on B and B depend on A, but if what A is accessing is always acquired before what B is accessing, then that's not going to be possible. So in our move file example, let's lock the directories in order by name, for example, by path. This means that if we have move file called for two different directories in different orders, we'll lock them in the same order, meaning that we can't have circular waiting. The first thread and the second thread will always be waiting on each other when they don't have any locks yet, because they already acquired the locks that have names which are just earlier. And note that any ordering will do. Doesn't matter what the ordering is, we just need to be consistent to make sure that we don't allow circular dependencies. Another way of thinking about this is, we remember I talked about our graphs. We have to have a cycle, but we can't have a cycle because all our edges are going to go in one direction. We're going to be able to sort the locks and have edges only going, you know, in one direction. We aren't going to have back edges when we do this sorting of when we acquire locks. So this is by far the most practical strategy, because aborting and retrying, had like this live lock problem, which is really annoying, in addition to being inefficient. Revoking locks like requires lots of support and is also inefficient. This is like almost no extra work and solves the problem. And this is in fact typically what's done. So for example, in the Linux kernel, they do this and they have comments telling people, hey, if you're using this code, these are the locks we have. So you have this semaphore, this other semaphore, and this lock, and you acquire the LDT user semaphore before you acquire the mmap semaphore, before you acquire the context lock, anytime you're using multiple of them. So in this way, we don't have problems, assuming everyone follows this rule, even though like maybe there's one function which accesses context.lock and not mmap semaphore, and one function which accesses, you know, pairs of two of them, you won't have any deadlocks despite that, because we have this consistent order with these locks. You see these other comments here. So that is the most common way to prevent deadlocks in practice, and probably what you should try to do when you're dealing with locks. Questions about ordering? So another option is if you can request all the resources at once. So for example, in our move files case, like the problem was that we had to lock A and then B, or B and then A, but we didn't have a way of, say, lock A and B at the same time. But if we could provide that operation, that prevents deadlock. So if we can just get all the wait for all our resources all together, no deadlock problem. And this is not often like practical, but you know, you can think of this as something that might be useful if you can like figure out, when I start the thread, what does it need? And just don't start the thread if it doesn't, that's not available, then that thread shouldn't cause any deadlocks because you know, there's not going to be waiting for any resources after it starts. And there might be some cases where this is actually practical. So in embedded systems, you might be able to say, these are the threads I'm going to be running because I know what hardware I have to deal with. And you can say, allocate these resources to the threads. There's no deadlock problem. Okay. So we talked about preventing deadlock. So questions about preventing deadlock? Okay. So talked about preventing deadlock. Another thing we can talk about doing is detecting deadlock. So I mentioned that, well, we can, you know, we have these systematic ways of preventing deadlock, but another useful thing is figuring out if a deadlock has happened. So one reason is just debugging, right? I would like to be able to debug my system and systematically determine, is there a deadlock right now, or are things just waiting for input? You know, what's happening? Another reason is that something like revoking locks might be something we only want to do if there actually is a deadlock. So databases, for example, commonly like allow deadlocks to happen and then detect them after the fact and fix them by like revoking locks and killing threads and retrying them later. So how should I detect deadlocks? So let's say I want to detect deadlocks that only involve mutexes and I'm writing a threading library. What do I add to my mutexes and or threads to do this? What information do I need to figure this out? Yeah. List of resources that threats are using. And we only care about mutexes. So the mutexes the thread is holding. So are using. Thread is using. So what does using mean?
Locking, I would say.
So locking?
Potentially lock.
Locking, and we also want to know what they already have locked. So we only care about mutexes. If we care about all other resources, we'd have to have those resources too. So what do we do with that information? Well, remember I showed you these graphs earlier. We can draw that graph. I can say, I can go through my list of locks. I can say lock A, you know, thread 1. I can say thread 1 has the lock locked. Thread 1 is trying to lock lock B. And I can look at thread 2's data structure and say, oh, thread 2 has lock B locked and is trying to lock lock A. And I can draw this graph. And I can use techniques we may or may not remember from 2150, a topological sort or a depth-first search, to figure out if this graph has a cycle. And if it has a cycle, that's a deadlock. Because we know that this graph represents things which are holding and waiting, or holding a resource that someone else wants. And this is how we can detect deadlocks with just locks. Some questions about this proposal? So to make this work, we also need a list of all threads somewhere. But probably our threading library needs that anyways. Other questions? So we see we can detect deadlocks. This is not a super cheap operation, but we could only trigger this, for example, if threads haven't done anything for a while, or from a debugger, and like actually find deadlocks. Now, problematically, if we want to do more than mutexes, this gets more and more complicated, which is why you don't commonly see this as a debugging tool that reliably helps you. Now, there's one case in which this sort of deadlock detection is like a little trickier. This is with divisible resources. So let's say I have 6 meg of RAM, and I have 2 threads that are waiting for 2 meg to be available. So you have a resource with this memory, and 1 thread which has a meg LP waiting for a key press right now. This is not a deadlock, even though thread 1 and 2 both want memory that the other seems to be holding, because we have 6 meg of memory, and when thread 3 is done, thread 1 and 2 can go on. And thread 3 is not waiting on anything that thread 1 and 2 want. So this isn't a deadlock. This might be some unfortunate waiting that we should fix, but it's not a deadlock, right? Because if we just let things happen, eventually thread 3 will finish, it will get its key press, it will terminate, free its memory, and then thread 1 or thread 2 will get its 2 megabytes of memory and be happy and keep going. But it would be a deadlock if thread 3 had a lock in common with thread 1, or if there were 5 megs of RAM instead of 6. So these are both cases where we look at, you know, so look at this case. This is what we have. We have thread 1 and 2 have 2 megs memory. They're both waiting for an additional 2 megs. But it's not a deadlock because when thread 3 finishes, one of them will get their 2 megs. It's fine. But if we look at the same situation with, say, thread 3 having a lock with thread 1, thread 3 waiting for a lock that thread 1 owns, this is a deadlock. Or if we look at the same situation with 5 meg of memory, this is a deadlock. So these are cases with this, with these things like memory, we can't rely on finding cycles. We have to do something more complicated, because we have to take into account how much memory is there, what does that mean? So we have cycles in all these cases, but we need more information to know if they're... So we're not going to go over the algorithm in this class for doing that. I just want you to know it exists, and it's not as simple as when it's just mutexes. Okay. And that's where we'll finish up today.